thanks for inviting me and thanks for coming to the talk today.
So Sash, do you want us to hold questions or?
No, let's talk. Let's have questions and because. Yeah, because some of this stuff, basically what I'm going to talk about, some of this stuff is what I have done already, and most of the second half of the talk is basically the direction where I'm going. So I would really like your input on that. Okay. So it's, I mean, I just kind of wanted to give sort of this basic picture, sort of sets up the background of what I'm going to talk. I'm basically going to focus on the ultra-low velocity zone. And this is just the sort of cartoon from Edgar Nero's paper and sort of showing the different areas. But basically, it seems like the thickness of that area, it's pretty thin, like 5 to 40 kilometers thick overall. The calculation that Williams and Garnero did, they were suggesting that there is silicate melting in that area, and their estimation was 5 to 30% of melt. And I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to test that a little bit. And another of the parameters that came out is basically the R parameter, the logarithmic ratio, that seems to vary between 2.5 to 3.2 in that area. And then there's also a bunch of experimental work, mostly from Michael's group. One of the crucial things also seemed that you need to have some sort of a low viscosity and high density layer to stabilize the plumes for a long term period. And you would also see some sort of lateral variability in the topography. So what I want to do today, basically, first of all, I want to sort of introduce a new microstructure-based model for seismic velocity calculation. This is something I've been working on for a while. And I'm going to use that model to sort of recalculate the melt volume fraction at the ultra-low velocity zone. And then I want to describe the topography part of the problem. And there are a couple ways I'm going to go about it. I'm going to take sort of a symmetric 1D approach using two-phase theory, looking at the effect of surface tension, grain size, on how that could influence the pooling of a dense melt at the bottom, and also look at the influence of viscosity contrast and the plume flux on the topography. And please feel free to stop me anytime. So one of the crucial things about the microstructural model that I'm going to talk about is this parameter called contiguity or contact between particles in a grain. So it's basically, there's this first paper that came out from Yasuko Take's work in 1998 where she basically looked at the poroelastic models and she was trying to calculate what would be the wave velocities if you change the area of contact between grains in a granular aggregate. And so she did find that you do have some kind of an influence of that microstructure. Now, one of the problems then is, what is the microstructure? What are the forces that control the microstructure? So that's the part where I am more interested in, sort of modeling the idea of what the microstructure in rocks look like. Another very key component in my talk is going to be this phenomenon of disaggregation. It's almost like, it's basically, this phenomenon has the same effect as phase change does in two-phase flow. Disaggregation has the same effect as phase change does in one phase. So basically, the idea is, on the figure in the top, this is an experimental sample. You're looking at olivine and water, actually, which has escaped during the picture. So you can see there are these water in the tubules along the edges of the olivine grains. The volume fraction of water or melt in this case is pretty low. It was less than 1 volume percent. So the grains have a lot of area of contact in between. This is another experimental picture of this is olivine and basalt, and the melt volume fraction in this case is about 30. So this aggregate is effectively like a mush. So there are very few areas of contact marked by the black arrows between the two grains. So basically, in this case, this is what I will call a disaggregated aggregate. Okay. So the other important part also, basically the interfaces in rocks, and that's a very characteristic issue that you have to deal with when you're dealing with two-phase situations, because you do have two types of interfaces. Am I focusing? Okay. You have two types of interfaces. You have the area of grain-grain contact, and you also have the grain-melt contact. So this is just kind of a schematic showing those two things. So I'm going to use the this parameter chi, which is basically the grain-grain contact times the surface tension of the grain-grain contact, grain melt, and surface tension of the grain melt contact. So that's my total surface tension. And then the other parameter, contiguity, which I talked about just a little bit earlier. So this is basically the fractional area of contact between grains. Okay. Does that make sense so far? Okay. Just definitions. All right. So how do I model the microstructure? What are the forces? What's happening? So essentially, in the under the condition of when rocks are sintered, the crystals themselves can deform in a viscous manner. So one appropriate way to go about that would be to treat the aggregate as two different, as a bunch of different viscous particles in melt. So those are the two phases shown here. I mean, this cartoon is showing a disaggregated aggregate. It doesn't have to be that way. You can position them. So now their motions are fully coupled. So within the grains and the melt, we got the standard Stokes type flow. I'm going to use this sans bold sans serif for tensors. So this is basically the velocity and mass and momentum conservation. An interesting boundary condition that pops up when you do problems like this, which is basically variation. This term on the left-hand side is the drop of traction across the interface. Now that can be balanced by two different terms. The first term on the left-hand side is the surface tension between difference of surface tension at the interface and times the curvature. So these two is basically what you would expect for, like, in a standard soap bubble type problem, where the surface tension is 1/ radius of curvature, balances the pressure, that type of stuff. The second term is more interesting. It's called a Marangoni term. What happens in case of an actual rock, when you have two grains touching each other, you actually, if you are traversing across the surface of a grain like that, if those two were touching, you'd have two different surfaces. One is the contact between two grains, and the other is the contact between a grain and a melt. And it turns out that that will give rise to a variation of the surface tension as you move along the surface. Okay. So that's and it's actually something that people use in chemical engineering very often. If you have like a bath, and where you are settling a lot of particles, and if you could set up a temperature gradient, you could put a lot of solutes on the surface on one side, and that basically drives the motion of bubbles stuff. It's a very useful industrial term.
But in this case, the example you gave, you went from one value of surface tension to another.
Right.
So that sigma then is zero everywhere except at that the contact line.
Well,
it becomes infinite.
No, it's not actually, because it's normalized. So it's the variation itself, though, I'll show you in just a second. It's kind of a mid-range force, so it does have a weak variation, but it's still non-zero when you move away from the contact line. So the other boundary condition is basically just a no-slip boundary condition at the interface. And then as the shapes change, you use something called a kinematic relation. So for each particle, the superscripts are basically corresponding to the number of particle. So for each particle, you have that shape function f, which changes with time, and this is basically just the velocities are affecting the shape. Okay. So now I take something like that and I solve it for multiple particles at the same time, so that all the particles see each other, interact with each other, and that basically gives rise to the steady state structure.
So that first equation, continuity equation, is that solved separately for melt and?
Right. Yeah. For it's separate for each phase.
Is there a reason to think that that holds, that there's no compressibility in the problem?
Well, it's still like, I mean, you are dealing in, most of these cases are like isobaric, so you are not like having a huge variation of lithostatic pressure type situation. So in that way, even if there were any compressibility of the fluid or the solid, you would still be pretty much, you know, like in a fixed state, so you wouldn't have very much variability. So you could...
It's only like the dynamic pressure is like they can change the density in this scenario.
Right.
Those are small.
Those are pretty small in under these conditions. So.
Unless you have like a very small pore space, right, with surface tension, then you could have like a large pressure difference between them.
Well, right. That's taken care of here, though. And we'll see in just a second. That right. does drive the shape of the thing, actually.
But probably still it's not a big effect on compressibility.
Not so much on the compressibility, that's right. So. Here is another interesting thing. There is this this idea called the mid-range forces. Okay, there you go. So basically, people see that in polymer sciences quite a bit. If you take two particles and if you bring them very close, before they actually get in contact, they could see each other and they could feel each other's force fields. The way it comes is you can think about that as most interatomic attractions is like a van der Waals type potential, which drops up very quickly, like r to the power 5, r to the power 6, something like that. But now, that's interaction between two atoms. But if you take a whole particle, that's got millions of atoms, right? So when you integrate that over the volume of the whole thing, so you know you are doing an integration which is an order r cubed over an order r 6. So basically, you end up with a much shallower declining field. So that's what basically the origin of the mid-range force is. So you can, like two particles which are even spaced tens of atomic distances apart would see each other's force field. So that's something, and we will see that that's what basically gives rise to our Morangoni term here and controls the shape. Is it? Did you get any questions? So how do I get the steady state grain shape? I do a couple things actually. First, I do like a linear analysis basically. So I take a perturbation, but I get an analytical solution for the shape of the particles for a given geometry. So in this case, what I'm doing here is I'm taking a standard Lamps type solution where I take the velocity and pressure fields and expand them in some kind of spherical harmonics. I could also take the surface tension on a single particle, and I can expand that as well in a series of Legendre polynomials, which is basically showing the symmetry of the system or the packing symmetry, what are the particles around. And then if I did that, then my perturbed shape of the particle looks something like that, where this f sub n, which is the perturbation parameter on the shape, is still an unknown. I plug all of those in, I solve for the velocity fields, plug them in, I end up getting this very nice ODE in for any order n, basically. And I can solve it directly analytically to get the shape of the perturbed case. So let me show you a couple. So these are two samples. In this case, this grain is basically seeing, in this case, it's got four other grains on its side, and it has a mid-range force, basically, which decays as... So assume there is one grain sitting on the top, and the mid-range force is going to be strongest here, and that mid-range force from that grain is going to decay as you move farther away. But if you have a bunch of grains sitting on all sides, you see all of their force fields, and that's what gives rise to this red arrow, which is the gradient of the surface tension, the Morangoni term. You can see the velocity field within the grains that are basically driven by that surface tension. So that's basically sintering, and it's kind of classical. There are different types in which grain shapes take place and sintering takes place. But it's more or less, there is nothing very unique about it, except for the fact that we could take this stuff and we can calculate these areas, the flat areas in these grains, because we could calculate the curvature at each point, and that can give us the area of contact, which I'm going to use to calculate the seismic velocities afterward. Okay, but this is a linear analysis, and you know, like the result or the shape I get basically still depends on the small perturbation, the magnitude of the perturbation I'm adding, and it's still somewhat arbitrary. So we need to do the full numeric solutions also. So basically, what you could do, you could take the for these type of problems, it's very standard. You can reduce the differential equations, the coupled differential equations, into an integral equation. So this was something that was found in, I think, 1960s, and was very popular in fluid mechanics, or especially in drop dynamics. So Michael did a lot of work on that for his PhD. So if you have any far-field velocity, which is very useful if I were to look at like the evolution of microstructure during deformation, which I'm not here, but that's where this thing comes in. You have this term, which is called the single layer integral, which is basically, it comes from the surface tension forces. It also comes from, in case you're looking at a bunch of buoyant particles like the diapirs we were talking about earlier, a bunch of particles sinking or rising, you would see the buoyancy forces come in here on that term. The second term here is basically called the double layer integral, and that's because of the viscous, that arises from viscous deformation of the particles. And then once you got the velocities by solving this very, very nonlinear equation, because remember, n is an unknown, u is also an unknown. Once we solve those for all the particles simultaneously, we can use that to update the shape at each state and get the eventually get the steady state shape. So just a couple points I wanted to point out, that in both of those integrals, you get these kernels, which are singular. In this case, I'm doing a 2D calculation. So this integral on the top is called Stokeslet, and the one on the bottom is called Stresslet, which is a third rank singular tensor, and the one on the top is basically a second rank tensor. So as R approaches R0, which is a point on the surface, this thing is going to shoot to infinity. So that's basically one of the challenges. I got a couple non-dimensional parameters in my system, which is what's going to cause a major, which are the parameters I'm going to control for my results. I get the ratio of viscosity between the grain and the melt. I call it lambda. And I also have the capillary number. So the capillary number is basically the ratio of the viscous deformation over the surface tension. So in the sintering problem, typically, traditionally in earth sciences, sintering problems are the steady state microstructures have always been considered to be something that minimizes the surface tension. And the grains have been generally considered rigid. But if you consider the deformation of the grains also, so you kind of need to take care of the capillary number so that you know how much of the influence of surface tension is actually going to be accommodated by the deformation of the grain. And then, again, this parameter of contiguity size, the fractional area of contact. So the grain over the total. Okay. So basically, just a very quick description of my boundary elements model. There are primarily three steps in how I solve these equations. I first discretize the equation, evaluate the singular integrals, and update the position of the Lagrangian marker points. We'll talk just a little bit about each. You could do discretization in a number of different ways in boundary element models. I use method of collocation, which is basically saying I'm going to take one point at the surface of one of the grains, and then I'm going to calculate the effect of all the other grains, other points in other grains, as well as these points on them. So it becomes pretty computationally expensive, because you got to wait, you have to get the values for all the other points. The position I need to interpolate in some way, because the curvature of at any element becomes very important. So I use a cubic spline interpolation, so that I can actually have the an analytical expression for the curvature of an element as soon as I know the position of the marker points. And I interpolate the velocity in a linear way, but you can also go on a higher order interpolation. The trickiest part, I guess, in all boundary integrals is the evaluation of the integrals. For the elements where I do not have, the integrals are singular in some elements and not in some others. where it's not singular, I can use just a simple Gaussian quadrature. So this is basically what a singular integral will look like if you're doing like 1 over r. It approaches to plus infinity as you go to 0 from the positive side, goes to minus infinity. So basically, if you're integrating over this beige-yellow area, the minus and plus infinities should cancel each other out. So theoretically, you should have a finite integral. So this is called Cauchy principal value integral. So I use this technique, the radial integration method, to do this very nasty integration. And then I use an optimization to calculate the velocity in the shapes. And then once I got that, I update the nodal coordinates using just forward Eulerian integration. You could also do other things, like you could do a Runge-Kutta or an implicit Crank-Nicholson. I have an adaptive mesh regeneration scheme, so if I have high curvature elements, which happens very often actually because of the singularities, I could remove the high curvature elements and have a relatively uniform curvature. And I keep updating marker positions until I get convergence. Okay. So here's some results. Two microstructure, two cases. In the first place, I have a capillary number of 5 × 10⁻⁶ and a viscosity contrast of 10,000. And in this case, the grains have the same viscosity as the melt, and the capillary number is still the same. Okay. So from these structures, you can see that the isoviscous case, the grains are a little more faceted than in the other case. And I can calculate the curvature at each point, and I can get the contiguity from that. So this is a map of the capillary number versus the viscosity contrast, and you can see the contiguity. It's actually not constant. It varies depending on the viscosity and the capillary number. The reason this result is important is because from most of the experimental work on contiguity, people do measure those. They would take, and I'll show some results very soon. And people have modeled this stuff also. But it has been always considered that contiguity only varies with the volume fraction of the melt. But this is why I was kind of excited to see this.
It's a cool result, really, because you wouldn't expect actually a steady state grain shift to depend on something like a viscosity,
right,
which is a kind of dynamic quantity.
Right.
But the key is that the surface tension gradient is actually
right,
providing a non constant
right,
driving force that's always present.
Yeah. It's almost like a diffusive process, basically. You're forcing the system to behave in a certain way by imposing, it could be surface tension, but you could deform also. You're imposing some kind of force, and that viscosity contrast is really modulating the kinetics of that process. And in some cases, the kinetics are so fast or so slow that you're never going to the point where you want to.
What John said actually isn't right, because even if there were no Marangoni effects, there's still a weak dependence on the viscosity ratio for the steady shape.
Well, I think in the case where there's no deformation, the system is like at rest, then the viscosity wouldn't matter.
If you put
if there's no deformation, nothing's
right,
moving.
You have to have a deformation happening for the viscosity to matter. And so I guess
sure.
So I guess the interesting thing to me is that the deformation is occurring and how that then allows the viscosity ratio to enter.
But even if there was no deformation occurring in the capillary number, the surface tension was finite. The shape is not a sphere because they're packed in.
Right.
So then there's a small viscosity ratio dependence on that steady shape.
And you would also see this some viscosity dependence also if you were to put a buoyancy effect on it. So for example, if you're looking at the diaphoric riser, the deformation of the diaphoric, you would still see. It's actually interesting.
But it's still there.
It's there. And the interesting thing is you do see that step-like behavior. Actually, Alan and I were talking about that yesterday a little bit, that you see most of the action happening near viscosity, isoviscous cases, but there is an area where you see the sharpest deformation and it kind of tails out. So I'm going to show that in a little bit also. So let's see what happens when I do the elastic properties. Here's the fun part. Okay, so I can calculate the effective shear modulus. I use the calculations. Basically, once I have my contiguity, Takei has a formula, and she has basically this photoelasticity model where you could get the effective shear modulus. So the effective shear modulus, when I say that, what I mean is basically you have a partially molten rock. take all the melt out. So basically, if you have a rock that's filled with vacuum and grains, the elastic modulus of that would be the effective shear elastic modulus. Okay, and so you can see that this effective modulus depends on the contiguity. Basically, it increases because of the fact that as you're increasing contiguity, which is as you're increasing the contact between the grains, the structure is getting stronger and stronger. Okay.
If you kept the melt in there, you could get interesting frequency-dependent specificity, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In terms of like attenuation. So.
You could do that probably. And also if you change the microstructure, you could also see some very interesting effects. Yeah. So, and there's some experimental data, actually, this little triangle here. That's the only experimental data I could find on that. It does fall within our range, so that was kind of interesting to see.
Well, mushes do attenuate more than complete solid.
Because of the fact that probably they have a much lower...
The elastic energy is somehow going into moving around some bit of liquid, and of course, it's nice viscously dissipated.
Right. Right, and you actually, I'll show you in a second, the shear velocity does see this effect, sample this effect much stronger. It's right here. So this is basically showing the contiguity for the seismic velocities, right? So this is basically Vs, that one, the pluses are Vp over Vp0, and the bottom one is Vs over Vs0. So basically, you can see, if I were to run this all the way up to contiguity of 1, these values would get up to 1. But the interesting thing is that the shear velocity shows a stronger dependence than the P wave velocity, and especially the effect of shear velocity is stronger in low contiguity. So basically, as you're getting closer and closer to high melt fraction, the shear wave starts to have a much stronger variation.
What's the best way to understand that? Just intuitive.
Okay, so does this part, that part makes sense, okay. So now think about what you're doing in this case is basically you are shooting the waves. Now the low contiguity almost mimics the effect of having higher melt fraction. Because the shear waves are strongly attenuated when you have a higher melt fraction, that's what you're seeing here basically. It's almost... Even in all of these runs, the melt fraction is the same. All of them have 9 volume percent melt. But you see the strong variation in shear wave in this area just because of that relatively very small change in the contact area between the grains. But it's just almost, it could sample, it has less support, basically, for the shear stress.
But of course, you have a volume change with the P waves.
No, you could, okay.
That's, it melts in the pore spaces, and that's the compressibility of that enters as well. But I guess in the shear, it doesn't enter at all.
Right. Well, also,
melts can still like hold up some of the elastic resistance, I guess, to deformation.
Yeah, I think that elastic resistance is there because the time scale I'm talking about for this attainment of the steady state is still much longer than, you know, like the time scale of the wave propagation.
Sure.
So if you're shooting the wave through, you're not going to, the wave itself is not going to change the contiguity, but it's just going to sample whatever contiguity there
right,
is.
Right.
So, I don't know, did that answer?
No, I'm thinking about like why does the changing the contiguity affect the shear velocity more than the
because the shear wave becomes absolutely zero, like right when there is no contiguity. Shear level will be zero. So basically, the P wave has to, it's kind of, you can think about in one way, the P wave varies between the P wave velocity through the liquid to the P wave velocity through the solid, whereas the shear wave has to vary from 1 to 0. So it's got a larger range to cover.
Another way of saying that is that the bulk modulus of the liquid's not zero.
Right. But the shear modulus
is zero, and that's what so that's what the low contiguity is basically sampling.
So how do you do these calculations?
How do I calculate the contiguity?
No, the vertical.
Oh, the vertical axis.
Structure and then.
So I have. It's basically. Once you know the contiguity, you do sort of a poroelastic averaging. So the averaging scheme gives the effective bulk modulus as a function of the contiguity. It's like a polynomial power. And then there's like experimental measurement of the coefficients of the polynomial, but it's available. So that was Yasuko Takei's work, basically. She calculated all of that stuff, both from experiments and the theoretical model. And then once I get that, then the rest is basically standard for elasticity. Then you just plug in. Once you get the effective bulk modulus and once you get the effective shear modulus, you just plug that in, and then you see the variation. Actually, another answer to your question also, John, that I am just plotting the effective shear modulus. If I plotted the effective bulk modulus, you would see that that would be much flatter than this. And that's why basically the S wave, because that's why the S wave shows a stronger variation.
I see there's a negative value over here for contribution.
Oh, no. It's zero. It's just the axis is that there. Yeah. Yeah, I always keep doing that, and people tell me I should stop. It's Scilab. Yeah.
Well, it's negative.
No, it's not. It's actually in zero. I should actually do like a logarithmic plot. Okay. So now the interesting part then, looking at the viscosity contrast, basically as we saw, that contiguity depends on the viscosity contrast. So here are two cases. The one on the right is basically direct calculations of the P and S wave velocities. You got two ranges of data. The circles are low capillary number and the pluses are high capillary number. Okay. So let me remind one more time. Low value of capillary number means that the surface tension, it's the capillary number is basically viscosity over surface tension, right? So basically, the one you are more likely to see on the Earth is the low capillary number rather than the very high value. Okay, but it's interesting that in both of the cases you do see there is a variation of the both P wave and S wave velocity. Again, remember, all of this is at a fixed melt fraction, about 9 volume percent. I don't vary melt fraction at all in my runs. So you see a variation, which kind of levels off afterwards. The capillary number 1 is very illustrative because it shows that you absolutely flatten out very clearly. So that's basically the raw data. If I took that and if I calculated the R parameter, I see that it kind of increases with the viscosity contrast, but then it just sort of levels out up there. There is a little bit of scatter in the data. The scatter comes from, the dense particle simulations are kind of, although I get rid of the high curvature elements, I still have some curvature, so I do have some kind of noise in the data. So that gives rise to some of the scatter. And then, you know, like S wave has a larger variation. So when I take that ratio, that kind of messes things up a little bit too. All right, so the other thing here is this box. This is something I took from Guy Masters' paper in the volume, the AGU monograph. And one of the things that he was suggesting in the paper, basically, I really liked it because he said, for the mineral physicists who are trying to calculate the velocities, you should be trying, the range we have is between this 2.5 and 3.2. So that was almost like, you know, having an idea. Because I hear that there is a lot of report, you know, like that Adam, you can probably tell us more about that, but the variation is 3-1, whereas there are also some other noise to that. So, but anyway.
There's the ultra low velocity zones have a -10% V drop.
And VP and 30%.
-10 and -30%.
Exactly. I think
the stuff that Guy Masters was talking about was larger scale, there was more of the piles and stuff entering. But R, you know, is for like these kind of things. I mean, for a signal as big as ultra low velocity zones, you can believe that ratio.
Right.
For something more subtle like the piles, it's completely constrained. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I went and did a statistical analysis. I found that R could be anywhere between 1 and 6, depending on which models and which kind of things you use.
I mean, you know, once you are over 2 or so, I guess you get net negative correlation between shear velocity and bulk sound velocity.
Okay.
So But indeed, what you said is that these ratios of 2.5 or so are observed over large areas and actually large volumes.
Right.
So it's not really just limited to the ultra low velocity.
Okay. I thought this one, this specific range that I think he was calculating this from the waves turning at 2900. Or
which paper is it?
This was a paper.
2000 paper?
Yeah, his 2000 paper in the.
I guess I'm the fourth author on this, but.
I think you are. Well, your model also does that, I think.
But I don't remember the box. The problem there is that, we are essentially measuring the deviations, the anomalies, with respect to zero average, and we don't know what the absolute level should be for,
the baseline comparison. Yeah.
So that sort of is a bit of complication in terms of establishing in some, but these fairly high ratios and the negative correlation between bulk modulus and shear modulus observed for very, what John calls pios, I guess.
Right.
They seem to be actually different for non-pio areas, which I guess probably further means that supports the idea that the pios are.
It supports the
composition is different.
I mean, it's based on the tomography.
So that this ratio actually does vary laterally.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely something distinctive that shows up in S waves that doesn't show up in P waves. Mm-hmm. So for sure there's something different there. And it's but as far as I just wanted to mention that
the
stuff is more like long period big large regional kind of stuff.
Right. Now that's why I put the S and P wave velocities there as opposed to just putting the R, because that's more like the raw data really.
Right.
And that's where we could do the better comparison.
What's Michael? The ratio for the ultra-low velocity zones? You said 10 and 30%.
So well, Williams and Garnero said that it was 10% to 30%. In Guy's paper, he was taking I do not remember which phases he was doing, but he was taking, and he basically used the R, and he gave that range between 2.5 to 3.2. So if it were just 10 to 3, I guess you would have 3.0. Or 2.9 or something like that.
There's also an earlier paper, I guess the first paper where this
unusually
high relative ratio was established was by Lee Giardini and Woodhouse JGR 1991.
Okay.
They did it for free oscillations.
Okay.
So that really, integrates the whole volume of the lower mantle.
What was the resolution of?
It's a very low resolution, right. I mean, in terms of the wavelengths.
But would it see the OVZ, which is only like 10 kilometers?
No. The thing is that, I guess, point I'm trying to make is that it could be that, the ratio of the order of three can be encountered only in ultra low velocity zones.
Right.
Very high ratios.
Yeah, very high.
2.5 are fairly common in the lower mantle.
Right.
That's what I recall from the paper.
The property of
not just the ratio, but the magnitude of the drop is enormous for these things.
Right.
No. So these velocity anomalies that I'm talking about are on the order of 1-2%. Nevertheless, the ratio is still very high. So the question is whether somehow it's connected with the partial melting, or is it just some sort of variation in the chemical compositional structure in a low mass mantle.
Yeah. Well, you can add the chemical components willingly, if you have no constraint on what the compositional variation is, and you can find something that will give you that value if you compare it to something else. But for a systematic variation, 3 is hard to get, I guess. I was talking to Clinton.
Well, I think that Guy, he would be here, later on, I guess, when he comes for the tutorial part. But
right.
He did some calculations, sort of first principle type of calculations, by varying the proportion of periclase or magnetobustite, I guess, to perovskite. He was able to obtain this type of ratio.
I see, okay.
Negative correlation, actually also negative correlation between shear velocity and density perturbations.
I see. Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, let me see. So, one of the things also that, you know, I have shown so far was my melt fraction was absolutely fixed. But if we want to kind of say, like, there is a melting, if we want to actually calculate the melt fraction, we need to make a connection between contiguity and melt fraction. So, ideally, that should also come from the direct calculations, and I am starting a code where basically I'll set up like a much larger grid and calculate the vary the number of particles in there and get that. But for now, there is a very, very good body of experimental data actually on that relationship. So this is just a figure from Yoshino et al. They did this very nice work, very thorough, calculating the area of contact. They actually plot here what's called wetness, which is the complement of melt fraction or contiguity, 1 minus contiguity basically. But you do see this square root of melt fraction dependence. So basically, once you know your contiguity, you can get the melt fraction from that, or the other way around. So I do that. And now, I just wanted to get back to this case of Williams and Garnier again. So they were using this model of spherical inclusions of tubules, right? And they found that the melt fraction range could be anything between 5 to 30 volume percent. 30 volume percent if the melt is in tubules. The problem is, at 30 volume percent melt fraction, we are beyond disaggregation. So melt is not in tubules anymore, it's a mush, right? So, but when I do this, this is my calculation, and this is for 9 volume percent melt fraction. And then basically, I can use that scaling, and this is for 15 volume percent. You can see that, again, basically, if the variation is between 2.5 to 3, you could probably pin it down. I cannot put a number to it, but you don't need that huge range of 5 to 30%, but you could have 10 to 15% melting, and you could get that kind of a variation on VS and VP, just from the microstructural model.
That's one that I bring up. I told you yesterday, you know, Ed Guarnero now says that 3 to 1 is not a...
Not necessary. Yeah, that...
Not even a number that we... A reference number that we
right.
can shoot for.
Right, and that's why I was just, you know, like, I'm thinking that, okay, if it's somewhere in that range, basically...
But it could be 1 to 1.
It could be 1 to 1 also, okay.
Observations 1 to 1.
Okay.
Yes, literally.
You know, the VS over delta, you can use the slowest...
Personal communication.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Alex Hutko was a student of Thorne Lake, just finished his thesis, had some study recently where basically he found that there's a region that they find, and he calls it the little U LVZ as opposed to the big U LVZ, where it's a 1 to 1, it's like -10%, -10%.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And but there are other places where the 3 to 1 ratio holds up really well, and so it seems like LVZ is not the same everywhere. There's a lot of
some level of variation inside. Yeah.
Yeah. So
one would be difficult, I guess, to explain.
Yeah, so maybe 1 to 1 within the, I think it's a number not well constrained, period.
I don't know what it would...
Well, it's a compositional variation,
having
actually, but that's what you have to take it as, I think, is that there's a very strong compositional variation associated with the LVZ because they're probably about 10% denser than ordinary mantle.
But and that's something that would require very large change in VP in order to match changes in the
assay. Well, everything has changed, so it's completely off the usual kind of trajectory. So the composition is probably very exotic in the phases and stuff in there.
Yeah, that's true.
So parts of it, but it's one thing to think about though is that the Coriolis boundary is an isotherm, right? It's the exact same temperature everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that's if say there's the same material, you know, if it's melted in one place, it has to be melted in another place. So what it means, if there's places that are melted and then places that are not melted, is that there are actual compositional variations in the LPZ itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only degree of freedom you have with thermodynamic freedom that allows you to do that. Does that make sense?
Well, does, not thinking about it too much, I mean, is that, sure, right at the core mantle boundary, but above the core mantle boundary, like within the...
Just a very little bit above.
You could probably have temperature differences.
Because of the fact, though, you could have a varying heat flux out coming out of from the core, right? So the heat flux, if the heat flux varies...
Well, the trouble is that, the trouble for ULVC is that they are in the places where there's the lowest heat flux. So there's almost no radial... So ULVZ, you can pretty much assume within like a few Kelvin approximation are isothermal everywhere.
And I see.
So, you know, it's not, you're not going to get large temperature variations one to another, unless you're going to make them really big. If you found like a really big one, maybe.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like they're very big though. I mean, at most like 40, 50 kilometers. Okay. Say that again.
And that would even be on the big side.
I
tend to agree with John that you wouldn't really, from a dynamical perspective, there's no need to make it all a homogeneous material everywhere.
Like, right.
It would kind of be more expected to be different
compositions
rather.
Yeah.
Yeah, the analogy of ULVC is with, like, say, the crust at the top of the Earth. The crust is highly heterogeneous in composition as well. In some places the crust is melted, in some places it's frozen.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with the ULVC.
It's the same thing with ULVC.
So, which brings me to the next one. So, I also want to take a look quickly, I don't have probably much time, what are the effects on the topography of the ULVC? So, sort of this two-phase type of dynamic aspect. So, basically, I'm going to look at it in kind of two ways. The first one I will do, look at the coupled effect of surface tension, compaction, buoyancy, and also deformation of the matrix. And then I'll also look at sort of the ULVZ as a plane and look at the variation of that with like plume flux and the ambient mantle flow. Okay. So the two-phase theory, I'm going to give a very, very brief description of it. It's basically a coupled viscous flow of the melt in the matrix. There are a few additional variations. There's a surface tension. There are individual pressures of each phases, and there is a friction or an interfacial drag between the two interfaces that characterizes the momentum balance. And it can also take the effects like disaggregation, basically, and the melt geometry. So which is kind of nice. So this is very brief. It's just like a 1D calculation that I'm going to do, just a very simple calculation to show what effects we could actually have in terms of storage of a heavy dense melt-rich layer. So we have the mass conservation. Phi is the volume fraction of melt, and W is basically the velocity of the matrix. It comes from a coupled set. I have eliminated a whole bunch of equations there. There's a force balance equation. The terms you are seeing, there are basically four different terms. There is a surface tension force, kind of a net, if you remember this term chi that I was talking about earlier, I should probably have put it up there. It's the total surface tension for an aggregate summed over the grain-grain interface and grain-melt interface. So it's the surface tension capillary force. This is a viscous deformation of the matrix, basically a compactive motion, gravity. And then there is a Darcy-type resistance that two phases always have, which is something that's usually not present in one phase. We also have a stress drop condition, which is also very unique to two-phase flow, where you have a surface tension that balanced by the pressure drop and also compaction. So you can think of it in a couple different ways. If all the motion were to be shut off, there were no motion, no change of anything at all, then this term on the right-hand side would be zero. And surface tension would be just balanced by the pressure difference between two phases. It's just like, you know, like in a gas bubble, outside pressure and inside pressure determines what the surface tension is going to be. On the other hand, if you shut off the surface tension, you can think of this as sort of a coffee filter type situation, where or a coffee press, where you're pressing down on the coffee, and even if the grains are very rigid and even if the grains are not deforming, it expels some water out of it. So that's what basically the phenomenon of compaction is, and that's balanced by the pressure drop. Okay, so I have two parameters. The first one that modulates surface tension over buoyancy forces, and then the ratio of different buoyancies. One of the terms you guys probably have heard about quite a few times, every time anyone from the two-phase community talks, they just go crazy about the compaction length. There are many ways that we can define it, but basically, the way I like it is basically to think of it in a physical way. If you take, in general, in two phases, the fluid moves as the rocks through the rock as the rock deforms. Now, the motion of the fluid through the rock is controlled by the connectivity and all sorts of things like that. So, this parameter here controls how far the fluid will move through the rock when you squeeze the rock. So you can think about that as basically a very inherent length scale of a two-phase system. And that actually changes based on if you have like an olivine basalt system or like a quartz and water system. But it's an inherent property of the system, and it's very intrinsic to the system itself. Okay. So there are some results from some work that I did for my postdoc, where I was just looking at the effect on a neutrally buoyant layer. I mean, I also looked at some other cases, but this is just to show the phenomenon. So in the left-hand side, in both cases, black is the initial melt distribution, red is the final case. So on the left-hand side, you're looking at a melt volume fraction over distance. The total melt volume fractions are so low that you actually have a very large contiguity, so that there's a lot of contact area between grains. So what's happening is basically the grains are kind of sponging up the melt into, and the melt gets like uniformly distributed. So this is a phenomenon I call homogenization. On the other hand, on the right, the overall melt fraction, you can see it's 30% on the background, so that's a lot of melt there. It's a mush. Okay, the microstructure would look something like that. You start with a little perturbation, it's going to grow because the melt is basically going to phase separate like water and oil. So that's a very important distinction between the two behaviors.
So what kind of time scales
are these are actually really super ultra fast, because all the motions of the melt, if you plug in the characteristic, the numbers we use a lot is olivine and basalt for a standard tubular geometry, you can move at the rates of I think like centimeters per year or something, so pretty quick. Depends on a bunch of things though. I mean, if you change the dihedral angle and block the pores, it's going to be much slower, but basically. So now the reason I bring up this picture is because the estimate we had from the mineral physics type model is basically we are not the scenario, if we have melting in the ULVZ, scenario we are more likely to face is the one on the left, not the one on the right, because it seems like it's not like an absolute mush. So what I did was basically, this is a simple calculation where I put kind of a dense melt-rich layer at the bottom and I have rocks at the top. And if there were no surface tension on the, or anything on the grains, basically you would see that the melt would be distributed in a step function-like behavior. Okay. Now what happens, these grains, the boundaries, are basically kind of sponging up the melt, and that's going to give rise to sort of a more like prolonged tail. So that could be one of the processes that can change the variation of the topography. Now, how could you, the parameter that controls that is this guy, Xi. One of the ways that Xi could be changed, this term here, surface tension, density, gravity, compaction length. Well, the compaction length can actually change if we change composition, but alpha zero is a grain size parameter. So the other properties being fixed, you can have a variation in grain size. Smaller grain size has basically more surface tension area, and you can see a behavior like that. Or as you guys were talking about, the compositional variation, or if there is any such thing like that, you could...
You're, But this doesn't involve like a, there's no density difference between the melt and the solid.
Oh, there is. The melt is denser than the solid.
Where does that enter into this, in this parameter?
It's in the governing equation before. So like there is the buoyancy term in the governing equation. That's where I put like a negative buoyancy for the melt, so the melt kind of pulls down. So so that's one of the ways that you could have the variation. The other thing also is the actual viscosity of the layer, because in these calculations I considered the melt as inviscid. If we were to take into account the viscosity of the layer, this is just kind of showing a data basically how the viscosity of rocks change with melt fraction, and this is kind of the desegregation phenomenon. This is laboratory measurement on this one. On the top is olivine and iron sulfide, and the bottom is olivine and basalt. You can see a pretty sharp 4 to 5 orders of magnitude drop in viscosity in both cases. Okay. So again, we are probably likely to be in this area here. So this is something that's very recent, and I just got started in this thing. So this is very, it's just kind of a quick and dirty thing. So basically what I'm trying to look at is, I put a dense blob at the bottom of what would be a plume-like structure. So I put kind of a sink of a prescribed strength up top, and then I have an ambient mantle. Basically that sink is driving the ambient mantle flow, and the two fluids, the fluid and the in the bottom pile, it's denser, number one, and it also has a lower viscosity or a different viscosity. So the two flows are coupled by continuity of shear stress across the interface, and their tangential velocities are continuous. Okay. So once I solve for that, I also have this equation that governs the topography, which is basically the vertical traction at the interface that's basically driving the topography to get kind of a gravity current-like situation. So these are just some simple analytical solutions, and I'm not going to, it's just illustrative of these effects can play a pretty important role. So the pictures in the bottom are showing the variation in the plume flux, or the normalized strength that I'm prescribing. So if you have a stronger flux, if you have a stronger suction force, basically you see a larger topography in this, and you do see a variation in the shape. The other case is also the variation of the viscosity. You actually see that in both of these cases, the lower viscosity layer actually shows a lower topography rise. The reason for that is, and this is kind of the flow field, so you can see what's the circulation like in the pile, or not the pile, but the little ultra-low velocity zone area. What happens is, because its viscosity is so low, it's coupled with the mantle in a much weaker way. So the mantle doesn't sweep it as effectively. It tries to pull more by gravity. So this is something that needs to be kind of looked up in more detail. But if we could do, one of the really interesting things that we could probably find, we could correlate, because in a lot of cases we do have direct measurements of the topography of the ULVZ. We probably could also have some kind of measurement of the plume flux. We definitely don't have any rheological measurement of viscosities of these areas. Mm-hmm. So this could be a very effective tool to sort of order for us geodynamicists to give some sort of constraint for the mineral physicists to estimate viscosity.
Michael, you and Mark worked on that kind of thing too, right? The viscosity ratio and the height of the thing. You can make some arguments about the plume flux based on the aspect ratio.
I mean, there's
that one slide. Another way to parameterize this rather than a sink is if you go back and put in your uniform extensional flow.
Right.
The extensional flow times the viscosity is a stress. And so you can couple the viscosity and the strength of the flow into a single parameter. And it's really the stress that's going to govern what the shape looks like.
Right.
And that'll explicitly give you the trade-off between viscosity and plume flux.
That's true.
So there's an advantage actually to replacing the sink strength with the
actual flow.
An extensional flow that has a uniform stress in the fluid.
I mean, I could also, like, right now it does have like the sink plus the extensional flow both together. So I could turn off the sink, and then what the shape looks like basically, it's almost like a hemispherical cap. So not much. I mean, it's really the sink or the extension, actually the sink that does most of the driving. But you know, it's also, I haven't explored the whole parameter space yet, but that might be a fun little thing to do. So, okay, here's my conclusions. So basically, if there is melt in the ULVV, assuming there is, I would argue that it's probably not a whole lot. I mean, it's probably 10 to 15%. That's still not too little. I mean, that's still quite a bit of melt. But that's probably the range we're looking at more. So what it means, though, the dynamical consequences that I want to make there, that it's molten, true, but it's not a mush. So it's not like extremely, extremely less viscous than the ambient mantle. It's less viscous than the mantle, but probably not like tremendously less viscous. And the other thing I also wanted to show, that the topography could be influenced by a lot of parameters: tension in the grain boundary, the flux of the plume, the density and the viscosity contrast, and you know, all of these parameters could be derived from a lot of different processes. So if you guys have any suggestions, anything about how to go about the rest of these things, I'll be very grateful.
Here's something. Well, a quick question off the top of my mind, that she said it again. So there's like differences in nomenclature sometimes between, some people would call an aggregated mixture a mush.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Slurry.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there any kind of uniform standard?
I don't think there is any.
I always wondered that, you know. So every time you mention it, you have to define it.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
I think the only thing that I kind of stick to is that disaggregation, because that one I think does make some, that does make physical sense or textural sense in some way. And obviously, most of the time,
I think volcanologists use those terms slightly differently. So
okay.
I think when we talk about slurries, people, it sort of implies something with basically no yield strength.
Yeah.
Whereas a mush will have finite strength.
Right.
Okay. So
all these quantities are frequency dependent.
Sure.
Especially at seismic frequencies.
Yeah.
Many of your calculations, you have a kind of cutoff in the viscosity ratio. Is there a just because it flattens out, or?
It flattens out pretty
so
much.
There's no reason.
Yeah, there's no reason for going much far beyond that. I actually, when I first submitted the paper, I went up to viscosity ratio of 10 to the 4. And I mean, it was pretty much obvious, and it was also obvious from the numerical, from the analytical solution, that it was not going to do very much. But I just kind of wanted to have some more. So I think I went up to, right now I went up to maybe a million viscosity contrast, but it doesn't do very much. So.
Yeah, there's you know, a lot of promise, I think, for, you know, the ULVC. I mean, if we can constrain its density better, and that's probably going to be laterally heterogeneous as well. But you know, if we have a place where we know the density is there, jump from like Sebastian Rose type of stuff, SCP precursors, then we could do some stuff like we could look at the topography and you could get an estimate straight up of the strain rate.
Yeah. That, if, yeah, I mean,
which is kind of cool, you know, if you think about it, you know, making strain rate measurements at the core mantle boundary, you know, it's pretty killer, and getting numbers out.
Well, it's because it's
you probably need the viscosity.
Yeah, more likely the viscosity.
Related to your presentation, but just, does anything further happen with these sediments at the core mantle boundary as an alternative to ultra low velocity layers?
The sediments?
Or Guarnero, I guess. That's Janos and Buffett.
That idea died of death a long time ago.
I see. Yeah.
I think the osmium people didn't like it, right?
No, the problem is that there's a lot of problems. The basic problem was with the mineral physics, is that the core is not saturated. You need to have the core saturated such that when it cools down, sediments start to come out of it, out of solution. The core is actually undersaturated by a large amount. Mm. So you can't have stuff coming out of it. More likely stuff is going into the core that can get into it.
It's got to be undersaturated in silicates or oxides of some sort.
Yeah, so they had basically the silicates, basically Nibble and Jeanlo kind of run the saturation, and then if you cool it down, then it runs in reverse slowly over time. It makes other predictions, you know, like that have a pretty uniform layer, it looked the same pretty much everywhere. It would be swept around and stuff, but you wouldn't have like places where you'll be seeing like distinct in one part, different in another part. It would be more uniform, probably. But there's, you know, the reason that they tried to do it was not to explain the ULBC, it was actually to make it electrically conducting there.
Yeah, that's right.
And so Bruce's idea was, and this is still like good stuff, you know, that if you have, I think it was like, it was a very large conductance layer at the nearly core mantle boundary, then you can have sort of magnetic torques,
yeah,
which exchange angular momentum between the core and the mantle.
And you had some change in day length that also
give rise to decadal variations in the length of the day.
Yeah.
I think it's still a good mechanism. Where that conductive layer is tough to say. You know, now the mineral physicists are saying post-perovskite can be highly conductive.
Well, there was this thing that,
you know, along the lines of post-perovskites can explain everything.
Jean-Paul Poirier and Dave Stevenson had this argument at some point, because Dave was suggesting that for that conducting layer, he was suggesting some sort of diffusion of iron out of the core, or iron-rich material out of the core conducting material. But apparently, if you look at the value of the diffusion parameters, there's this activation volume parameter, which is basically saying that the pressure effects are going to be so large at that pressure, at those pressures, that even if you have a compositional contrast, which is basically going to drive the diffusion, it's going to be shut off because of the pressure effect.
Yeah, so. But it also is a problem of like corrosion, kind of.
Dave and I were talking when I first showed him this sort of wicking up things. I mean, that's one of the things he thought that would be interesting.
It's like if it goes forward just a little bit, that causes it to shut down again, because that eliminates the ability for species to migrate and have diffusion. Yeah. And there's also a redox issue with having that kind of mechanism work as well.
Well, yeah.
So it's really difficult to get iron out of the core, I think.
Louise and Scott King had a paper. She's coming on Monday. You guys can talk to her. Because they did something, right? And they were showing that you cannot get it out.
Getting iron out of the core, I mean, the density difference is absolutely immense. It's like 5.5 or something.
Yeah, something very large.
So it's, you know, you can't. It's hard to imagine, you know, no matter how much, I mean, the osmium story came and went in several cycles, but that's also been scuttled. That's not, nobody believes that. There was also the iron manganese ratio story, which, you know, it's also hard to believe that you can get enough iron out of the core into the mantle and train it up in the flows.
Michael,
so what do you think of the experiments that Leslie Hayden and Bruce Watson did with Nature last year? So I think they were looking at, I don't think they put iron, they put nickel, and it was all grain boundary diffusion.
I think
they argue that the diffusive transport away from the core is much larger than you would assume from bulk diffusion.
Oh yeah, that's right. I know about that one. I think that might happen. There is no, because what the idea that Jean-Paul put together was for volume bulk diffusion, so I don't think he had values for the grain boundary diffusion. So yeah, I mean, that's actually, you know, that's, if you could coat the grain boundaries, that's a fantastic way to diffuse things out fast, because that's how they make superconductors. So you take a ceramic material, you soak it in some kind of melt, you take it out, so you have a very thin film of melt along the grain boundaries, and then that's the fast pathway, so you diffuse stuff like super fast.
But it's, you know, even if there's a pathway and a way to do it, there's still the fact that you're going the wrong way of the chemical potential gradients.
But are you though?
Yeah.
Because you have the concentration drive.
It's not concentration, it's chemical potential.
Right, but they, like the two major things that would go there are the concentration and temperature, right? So you take mu equals mu naught plus RT ln X, right?
No, it's essentially to bring stuff up into the mantle and mix iron into it results in an increase in Gibbs free energy.
Right.
So it's not going to happen.
No, I know, but
basically, what those guys were saying, though, that drive was there, I think they were saying that it's the kinetics that was the prohibitively small.
So right, but here that would be the activities.
Right. You could do the activity, but it's still the same thing basically. If you have, so if you're going from iron rich to iron poor, you still have the gradient of activity there, right? So
you're no, but not there. Gradient equilibrium.
But there is no iron in the mantle, though, right? I mean, if you're diffusing iron or the conductivity.
No, there is some in the mantle. There's the equilibrium amounts. There could be motion of stuff up and down, but it's never increasing or decreasing on either side. It's a dynamic equilibrium.
Yeah, I see.
So, you know, you have to have a, you know, assuming that you could even find a pathway, you have to have the chemical potential gradients working out in your favor. In this case, it's not. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of reasons to believe that we're not going to get iron out of the core.
Right.